This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Lana Loktev. Today we'll be discussing communication with Daryl Becker, who runs the blog Voluntary Visions. He'll discuss the skills of the Trivium method of critical thinking in conjunction with the skills of using voluntary communication or nonviolent communication in order to produce greater inner and interpersonal, intellectual, and empathetic equilibrium. Did you get that? Well, without saying anything further, I'll bring on Daryl to explain. Welcome, Daryl. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
So give us an introduction into who you are and what drew you to the study of voluntary or nonviolent communication.
Well, what drew me into all of this, let's see, it really did very much for me start with trying to take a reading on the many messed up factors of the world. This is a couple decades ago, essentially. And I went through various series of New Agey type books, such as The Celestine Prophecy, and trying to essentially see some of the bearing witness of the problems of the world. Another one, The Story of B, the other one, Ishmael. These are Daniel Quinn books. I called them bearing witness books, books that essentially were bearing witness to what the authors were contending were the problems in the world. And as time went on, eventually, the internet happened. And then when I moved here to the island of Hawaii, high-speed internet happened for me personally. And with that, that began unzipping more than just these various, I would say, metaphysical and highly out there components that were being explored by the authors that I was looking into. And it began to go a bit further and more into the realm of the actual political assumptions that I had previously made. I found essentially the work of Jan Ervin of Gnostic Media, and he was the one to not just introduce me to the Trivium method of critical thinking, as many other people were introduced through him and his work, but also he introduced me to Brett Vinat of the School Sucks podcast. And it was there that I quickly saw that there's something called the non-aggression principle. There were steps leading towards understanding how people could live in harmony with each other, minus actual coercion, which would require people to actually define what coercion is. And so these were all these logical steps of understanding these things. It's just going through bearing witness, where I just essentially am thinking of a concept and absorbing my own internal emotional response to that, but not really having any action plan attached to it. Then I was given the Trivium method, which we'll get into at some point, which is just essentially an explicit or very understandable, explainable method of critical thinking, of fact-checking, of a methodology of knowing and understanding or learning and then eventually teaching any particular subject. There was still a problem in even understanding the logical fallacy lists was when I saw myself or anyone else communicate to someone else when they were using a logical fallacy, there was a defensiveness, or I would have to say a disagreeable emotional responses that were usually happening. And I saw that there were limitations to this methodology, which then through Brett Vinat, he introduced me to Wes Bertrand of CompleteLiberty.com. And there, that was my introduction to nonviolent communication, a completely dovetailing method of essentially empathetically communicating to people. So this was a process of the last 5 years of finding and putting these systems together.
Do you know who it was who actually coined the term voluntary or nonviolent communication?
Well, nonviolent communication was, as far as I know, coined by Marshall Rosenberg, the student of Carl Rogers, who essentially, as far as I can tell, took the 19 major points of Carl Rogers and very quickly connected the dots between two very important ones, that being the emotional response within an individual and the motivating factors, which at first in 72 he called action-oriented wants, W-A-N-T-S. And later on, by 92, he had that codified into the word needs, which was essentially referring to the motivating factors such as values, desires, and physiological or ephemeral needs that were the genesis or the cause of any individual's emotions. So essentially, he was the one to do that. When I was speaking with Richard Grove over at tragedyandhope.com, another place that I spend a bunch of time at, I heard him directly codify it as voluntary communication, and I was like, yep, that sounds great to me.
Now, before we get into the four D's of disconnected communication, what would you call the type of communication most of us are involved in on a daily basis?
For the most part, I don't like to give a hasty generalization for everyone that I've never met about what they do and don't do. But I will say that I will call it usually less conscious about their internal terrain. Usually they might be conscious of a surface level feeling such as frustration, but there are deeper feelings usually almost always findable underneath a surface emotion. So just to define that, I would say it would be, I would call it like usually missing grammar or missing the component knowledge, the who, what, where, and when of themselves while they are communicating with someone else, or just even while they're trying to communicate to themselves. There's usually missing pieces of information. So I didn't want to give it like a label to say people are all speaking jackal language, which is a term referring to the use of the four D's, which we're going to get to, that of essentially giving oneself or other people diagnoses that were unrequested, labels essentially, the methodology of denying responsibility, that of essentially saying, you know, it's not my fault that I'm feeling this. It's external. It's someone else's fault that I'm having this emotion. So there's a lack of control internally. Mm-hmm. The deserve-oriented language, that of, you know, essentially, I deserve this, they deserve that. Whether it's a punishment or a reward, it's part of extrinsic motivations, such as what is taught in public schools. And naturally, there's the nastiness of giving demands, which is different than making a request where you can opt out. Making a demand of yourself is as disconcerting as making a demand of someone else. It's different when there's an actual opt-out option. So when it comes down to it, many people are just more like they're missing information about what is actually motivating them. And when I mentioned surface level feelings, I meant that as frustration or anger, jealousy, shame or guilt are, to me, as far as I'm saying, surface, because every single time when I question myself or others, I'm finding that deep down, there's also simultaneous emotions being felt that I would have to say are just as important to focus upon, such as anxiety, fear, which can only be held on to for so long, and then, of course, sadness or the grief over a missed opportunity of sorts.
Now, you brought up hasty generalizations, psychological intrusion, demands, deserve-oriented language. All of those are violent, wouldn't you say?
I would say that they would lead to less preferable situations. I like to like use the words that are a bit less wobbly. When people hear violent, they're thinking of actual physical violence often. In the same way as if you go to the Center for Nonviolent Communication, cnvc.org, you will see a list of needs and you'll see a list of feelings, the feelings inventory, the needs inventory. These are excellent lists. But the problem that I would find with the word need is people will basically interpret the word need as only physiological needs. And in the same way, people will interpret violence as only physiological violence. Now, I realize that, of course, you could have disagreeable words go back and forth, and that in the meaning that people did not desire a specific word. They were actually desiring other types of words. But the gift of words that came at them was not what they, you know, would have actually ordered if they actually had the capacity to order whatever someone else was, as if it was a restaurant and what you're getting is, you know, what you're putting on your plate is voluntary, like a buffet. But instead, it's not like that. You're getting the words that someone else chooses, their own preference, to deliver to you. So the thing about it is interpretation. It's like insult. Insult requires that you interpret the words as the insult. It would require also that you actually are taking it. In other words, it's like words are the action, and then you have to actually be the target that actually accepts it and takes it in. And then after taking that insult in, then you could then form your emotional response to it and say that it was external, that it's out of your control. There's another alternative. You could just take words for being words, and that it's the other person is tipping their hand as to what motivates them, and also tipping their hand as to what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
This is vital information, I would say. And unless they're a superlative actor, this is likely to be somewhat of a genuine actual diagnostic of what's going on within them. And by diagnostic, I mean yielding practical information that can be utilized.
That's why a lot of times it's just good to listen, because the other person always reveals their deck of cards.
Precisely.
Now, is this sort of communication, voluntary communication, is this something that we all have the ability to develop, or are some people just inherently better at it?
I would probably speculate that in the same way as the trivium method of critical thinking, you're born with it. It's instantaneous. I would say that I see most children have this, generally speaking, intact. It's just that in the difference that I would speculate, though, in terms of the trivium method of critical thinking, that of input, processing, and output, or putting things in order of your knowledge, who, what, where, and when, then going to processing or understanding, asking why, like the little toddler does, and then finding a practical application, meaning actually applying the knowledge and understanding to create a predicted result. That takes a little bit more trauma to break from a child. But the conditioning necessary to break empathetic communication or voluntary communication, I think, is less trauma. It would take less conditioning to break this. I speculate that children and animals are great creatures to look at, you know, we are creatures, you know, so whether little or big, but to see little ones who are essentially having all of their fundamental values and desires being respected, you will see this type of communication as being automatically intact. If you spend some time traveling to places where people are living much closer to the earth, as I have, you will probably do notice that children are crying less and are being held more, are trusted to a greater degree. I did learn this somewhat first before I did extensive traveling from the book The Continuum Concept by Jean Liedlaft. But I saw it in practice actually as well when I went to Peru, a bit when I went to Jamaica as well for that matter, and when I went to China. I got to see, you know, that, by the way, I was in China when I was 14, but I did, you know, upon recollection of that, which was back, just to date myself, that was 1986 when I was 14. So, so you can give a perspective of who is Daryl Becker. I did see examples of this. So it's my speculation, Lana, that people are born with these methodologies implicitly or implied. It's just that there's traumatic conditioning can happen, can quickly break the ability for one to connect within oneself and see what's going on and find a practical application of this information. And then likewise, after you're standing strong, to see what's going on in someone else. And you can actually even consider giving them a hand up, because as we well know, you can't really give someone a hand up if you're already on the ground.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think what you're saying, there's a lot of truth. I mean, a lot of kids, I always wonder about this. What happens to some people when they're just not kind? There's a lack of kindness. So somewhere along the line when they grew up, they were beaten down or some trauma happened, and now they don't know how to be kind with other people in their conversations, and they don't even realize when they're being unkind.
Well, yeah, I think that this is just part of the missing information. It's kind of like the list of informal logical fallacies. You know, there's like a pretty good list of 42 of them that Michael Lebeauzier wrote out. And then there's at least about a good 200 of them that have been discovered, most of them being variations of one or the other. Essentially, all of these are methodologies of silently, hopefully, in one's own head, as like a virus scanner, checking the reality of how likely things are going to yield a predictable and desired result. And that's on the intellectual side. On the empathy side, it comes down to what are the feelings involved for the person who's speaking. Right now, that's me. For the person who's listening, that's you and perhaps Henrik in the background over there. And then all of course, everyone who's going to be listening to this interview. What's the reality of my audience as far as their feelings and what is motivating their feelings? So it's this missing information that seems to be at the crux of miscommunication or unfortunate communication that's not really yielding anything that's nearly desired or practical.
You talk about the intellectual and empathetic lenses, which is also relevant to the discussion of how NVC fits with Trivium. So what factors are instrumental in helping one to focus on reality? How do we properly use these lenses that you're talking about?
I think to use a lens, you first have to be able to understand the lens. What is the lens of the Trivium? And though I did describe it, I'll try to make it march and say it again. Essentially, it comes to having things within a very effective order. What the effective order that I've found is who, what, where, and when, which is knowledge, also known as grammar or general grammar. And this is just an organization of how you see any child would put things together. They would essentially look at, what are these? These are sticks. They're getting the various different size of sticks, from little tinder sticks to the great big logs that are ready for the end process. And the process of, why does the fire work when you build this and put the sticks together in this fashion? You know, and it, why? Why? Because it works in this way, because if you stack them in this way, it makes the fire. If you stack them in this way, it smothers the fire. And so there you're getting the practical applications of understanding why or processing. And then there's the actual practical applications of the knowledge, building the fire. So any little child who's paid attention will see this information. They'll get the grammar of the sticks. They'll get the logic of how to build the fire, and they'll put it into practice, which is called rhetoric, which is another synonym for wisdom if it's practical, but it's not if it's not practical. Like what the words that I'm saying, if they're not practical, it's not wisdom. But if you can use them to affect something that's desired, that's practical. That equals wisdom. So it comes down to that part of the lens. That's one aspect of looking through it, as well as the rhetorical triangle where the author is understood, the audience is understood, the message is understood, and it flows around in that triangular pattern. That's the intellectual lens. The emotional or empathetic lens, nonviolent communication, is predicated on understanding first two very important concepts, the tangible, which begins with observations, flowing into what is automatically figured out as emotions. You see things, you hear things, like I heard your question, Lana, and I have an emotion come up because I know, it's like, oh man, she wants me to explain the lenses. I better explain the lenses. Okay, so I have the feeling come up of like, you know, better be on it, Becker. You know, this is your chance. This is Swedish internet radio, so get ready. You know, so that's the, you know, there's you have that little bit of impetus, that feeling that happens. But the feeling is correlating to simultaneously something else that's intangible. So the observation is tangible. The feeling is intangible. You can't find the feeling. It's there. There's cause and effect that you can see evidence of it somehow existing, but it's intangible and abstract. This is the origin. The origin of that feeling is coming from the intangible motivating factor. For me, the motivating factor is communication and connection. I want to connect to you guys and your audience, which essentially is something that I want eventually to be my audience as well. I want to communicate something that I have found very practical. I want to eventually get feedback so I could find ways of better communicating in the future. I want ease and efficiency so I have my words flowing one after the other and I have some sense of organization. These are desires, ease and efficiency. These are ephemeral. They are not tangible.
And I want to help get good information out there. So this is a partnership, right? A voluntary communication and exchange.
Right. And so we have that. So you have your own motivations. I've got my motivations. Those are still intangible. And then it comes to the tangible, the actions. These are my words right now. That's my action. When it comes down to it, these were codified by Marshall Rosenberg as observations, once again, in the realm of the tangible, like I hear your words, feelings, which is my own internal feelings, the motivating factors, that is essentially what motivates the feelings inside of me to occur, which are essentially correlated to however well I'm doing, you know, in terms of making the motivations happen. And then the actions or requests, that's what he called. So observations, feelings, needs, and requests is how he codified this methodology. It's an endless circle that goes round and round, starting from the tangible, flowing to the intangible, tangible observations, intangible feelings, intangible motivating factors or needs, as he called it, and then tangible requests or actions. And this is, that's one part of the lens. Now, very important here. One part of the lens means, so that's OFNR, observations, feelings, and needs, requests. Now it's how is it applied? That's another part, internally, meaning I'm taking an internal inventory of all of that, mm-hmm. both my internal trivium method and my internal OFNR method. I'm taking an external observation of how things are going with you and your choice of words and you and your feelings, and to try to quickly figure out what motivates you, you know, as far as I need to. That's an example of using these tools. Using the 4Ds of disconnected communication is a similar method as using your informal logical fallacy list as your virus scanner, essentially. I'm looking to see, to make sure, first of all, that I'm not delivering demands or giving a diagnosis when someone didn't pay me for it or ask for it or in some way deliver the explicit permission to understand it. So in other words, you know, there's this thing where, you know, you're not supposed to judge people. That was that idea, you know. I'm taking a tangent from the 4Ds for a moment to say something about judgment. Essentially, I don't want to dissuade people from making internal evaluations. That's how we get things done. What I'm trying to possibly suggest is to keep that silent to oneself, that when you're essentially making an evaluation of someone else or yourself, you're looking for the practical application of that. And of course, I've found the practical application of a diagnostic means that you have a treatment plan attached to it that is effective and that there's some evidence to show that it's effective. Obviously, calling someone a name has been shown to be ineffective over and over again. So I generally say maybe hold off on giving someone a label, especially yourself. Maybe go for instead just trying to understand like the purpose of the label. The next one, the denial of responsibility, that aspect of, you know, you made me so angry, so I just had to start talking louder and faster. That's all your fault. It's essentially denying responsibility. It does require that I define responsibility the way I'm using the word, which is the ability to respond, responsibility. And that's different than obligation, which is actually completely a different thing entirely. I realize that people will use that word responsibility in their speech or in their mind and define it that way. But I would probably suggest in the spirit of and also, rather than either or, perhaps you could look in other ways to define that word. And then, of course, there's the deserve-oriented language, punishments and rewards, that type of thing. I look through this lens to make sure everything that comes out of me, it's got a pass, so it's not something in one of those, if possible. And also, if someone is coming at me with one of those, that's them tipping their hand, and they're sort of showing me a little bit of what they're feeling, and they're showing me what motivates them. That's information. I can use that.
Yeah, that's right. Now let's talk about cognitive dissonance, because we all have that. So how do we go about removing our own sources of cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, I liked a friendly term called splinters in the mind, mental splinters and emotional splinters, the two flavors that I found I was able to identify. And essentially I used that to, instead of cognitive dissonance, which is a cold and clinical term, because everyone's had a splinter I know if you've heard me on some of these other productions, you've heard me go into this. Most people would never touch someone else's splinter. That would be very rude. So you have some respect. Splinter is not considered a permanent condition. The reason I'm using this term right now to describe cognitive dissonance is so that instead of saying, oh, we all have cognitive dissonance and there's nothing you can do, I'd say, hey, it's like a splinter. You could just take the time to identify it, figure it out, and pull it out. And when where that space is, where you pulled the splinter out, because you know that essentially leaves a hole, you can fill that hole. You can pack it with salve. You can definitely essentially make it work again. It can heal, you know, just like any little splinter pulled out of a foot, basically. I'm looking for more hope, basically. Cognitive dissonance is not a permanent condition. It's a situation wherein there's conflicting mental situations, such as the use of an informal logical fallacy. The knowledge of the informal logical fallacies helps you identify the mental versions of these splinters or cognitive dissonance. The use of the 4Ds of disconnected communication helps you realize the stimulus, emotion, and pre-programmed, especially from past trauma, responses that happen, so that instead you can take a different plan of action, essentially. This is what I mostly want to like focus on, is that, you know, the major purpose of why essentially I have been writing and making these productions is I'm seeing, hey, with these methods, with both sides, with these two lenses, intellectually and empathetically, the most important person to fix is yourself. From there, any family difficulties, any interpersonal difficulties, you know, you will find you can stand strong amidst that, but it starts with your own internal environment, basically.
Yeah, it's hard to catch yourself too in your own pre-programmed responses. Sometimes you can notice yourself doing it. It helps when you have maybe some friends you spend a lot of time with, or a husband or a girlfriend or something, because they can help you. Hey, you're doing it again. You're doing it again. But it's very difficult to catch yourself.
It gets easier and easier if you have a methodology, I find. See, what I've laid out is essentially an explicit methodology. I realize that if this sounds really abstract to you, as I've heard people say, that's very abstract. Yeah, it is abstract. It's like, so is the idea of a car and a driver is abstract until you have practice being a driver of a car and being part of that system called car and driver, basically. When you have just an implied version of, oh, that's cognitive dissonance again, I guess, or I guess I just used a logical fallacy, I guess. Well, that's the first step is observing it. The second step is saying, okay, so how would you want to do it otherwise? And so what I've laid out essentially is like, I want to have my grammar first, my information, just like a child would, first looking at the sticks, then the logic of how it sets up to make a fast fire, how it sets up to make a smolder fire, and how it sets up to make a failure of any fire. You know, it just puts itself out. This is just essentially how physics or the world seems to work. And the same thing is within our own internal terrain, intellectually and emotionally. So it comes down to seeing the cause and effect and having an explicit or explainable method. That's where I see often is lack, basically. There's this implied aspect going on often within communication.
I think another key is to really slow down and try and be in the moment and think about what you want to say before you say it.
Right.
That really helps.
Yeah, thinking does help. I tried to think about everything I was going to be speaking about for this specific interview. I got my notes in front of me. I've got pen and paper, my capture device. So I'm definitely, you know, it's a process, basically. There's a learning curve for all of us. I'm basically only 5 years in terms of like my Trivium studies, about 3 years into my nonviolent communication studies. And then in terms of actually applying them together, that's probably closer to a good, squishing it into, I don't know, probably a good year and a half. So these are methodologies that I've been essentially like trying to fold and apply and seeing how they overlap with each other. I honestly must say this. There is a book, Nonviolent Communication. It is written in such a way that chapter 9 is self-empathy. And as you can hear the way I was just describing, not just the tone in my voice, but also in everything I've just said up until now, what I was describing was the internal equilibrium, which I'm going to get to, is the goal, because that's the major strength of systems such as nonviolent communication and the Trivium method, is gaining internal equilibrium so that there is a balance, whether with thoughts or a balance, whether with emotions. There, balance meaning that essentially you're not riding the roller coaster of emotions and not essentially saying, okay, I know life has highs and lows, but at this point, I'd like to come back to an even keel so that I could focus on this thing right in front of me, this person right in front of me. And that's essentially the gist of where I'm headed with this information.
Now, talk about some methods to help generate, you were talking about bridges of empathy between individuals.
Yeah, that's the very important thing. So splinters, I did identify. These are the cognitive dissonance, intellectually speaking. These are the traumatically created, pre-programmed emotional responses. That's emotionally. These are aspects that make a difficulty, basically, between two people who are communicating, and even just in one person, just unable to navigate their life and their choices. Between people, it's as if every individual is a separate island. That's how I would look at it. And in order for, say, my information, my logic, my presentation that I'm making right now to cross from me to you, the listener, what it seems that I'm required to do is create a bridge first. I can't just hurl my stuff and say, here it is, and you're wrong if you don't believe it. That's like me just taking my 18-wheeler truck and I'm hurling it from my island over to your island.
Yes, it is.
And of course, it's landing in a fiery wreck. And you're like, no, Daryl, that's not how it is at all. Here's how it is. And you throw your 18-wheeler. It was pristine when it left the island, but man, it lands in a fiery wreck. That's absent a bridge. A bridge is the empathy connection of respect and caring and understanding. This is intangible, but it is palpable, or somewhat supportive evidence can essentially show that this exists. So with you and me, we've had very polite conversations email-wise up until now, and it all built a solid bridge that we could communicate, we could make a great production today, 13th of October 2013. We're making it work just fine, but in order to do that with our logic, we had to make a bridge, meaning there was communication going on back and forth, requiring changes of recording date and things like that. All of this was opportunities where when we could just show that we, show evidence that we care about each other. So that, yes, you're right. There are four methods. I would say eight simple methods that I wrote in my essay on essentially how to better generate the bridge. And they are predicated on all of what I just said, the knowledge of observations, feelings, needs, and requests, but using your intellectual Trivium methodology to understand this. So starting off, if I was going to be making a bridge with someone, say, who would be holding conclusions that are at odds with the conclusions that I'm holding, the first thing I'm trying to do in creating connection is I'm trying to show that there is respect for each of our specific positions. I hold the abundance perspective, meaning that the perspective that it's an and also situation. I can have the conclusions that have been functioning well for me. They can have the conclusions that are functioning well so far as they think for them. I didn't mean that as a jab. I mean like that so far as both of us think, we both have conclusions that we're operating with because of our past experiences. So I'm trying to essentially offer that, maybe they might have a desire for me to change my conclusions. I'm not necessarily desiring for them to change their conclusions, although I am interested to see if they're open to hearing about what it is that I would conclude. I'm looking to see that first off, I want to communicate to their motivating factors. This is on the inventory list of needs. If you go to cnvc.org and you look up needs inventory, you'll see that list. They are nouns, but they're very abstract. They're not specific. They don't include specific strategies. So, for example, companionship and intimacy is a need, but to get with one specific girl is a strategy. So you hear the difference right there. There's very specific things. Like, one is abstract, one is tangible. So I'm going to speak directly to the abstraction of what it is that the other person is after. I'm going to ask questions about what it is that they are asserting, and through that, I'll find out what it is that motivates them, such as, for example, safety and security. Many people will support the idea of a desire for a coercive monopoly-style government that is, for their own perspective, required or highly desired as a methodology of producing the results that they wish. Safety and security is one of them. That's on the list of your needs inventory or motivating factors. So I might speak directly to say, hey, I understand you have a need for safety and security. I have that need too. So I just wanted to let you know I'm aware of that. And that's one method. It's called reiteration, or speaking directly to what someone else has previously said. Although if they didn't mention the motivating factor, it would be speaking to the subtext of what they're after, essentially. The other method would be speaking to, what it is that I'm after. You know, my own motivating factors, essentially. I could, especially if it's something that is shared in common with them. I might not do this if it's in opposition or it's completely different than what the person is after. I might choose to keep that to myself, what it is that I'm, what motivates me. If it could be confused for something that would be divisive, for example, like that I have the real deal for the motivating factor and they don't. But I could communicate in the and also perspective. Hey, I respect yours, here's mine. I might speak in vulnerability. I might display, here it is, how I'm feeling. I'm on another interview and I'm a little nervous. I could reveal my emotions. That has potential to connect by making myself a little bit vulnerable and showing my feelings. Although, you know, some people that would not be appropriate, because if someone wanted to focus on what they're feeling, me saying how I'm feeling is kind of a change of subject. And that's, of course, the logical fallacy of the red herring. You know, they might want to focus on one subject at a time in the trivium method, which is a very rational way of speaking. So I keep that in mind. You know, I might mention it, I might not. But it could, of course, create a bridge, a connection. And then, of course, I could speak to how the other person is feeling. Unless, of course, they don't want to have that revealed. That would be intrusive. In other words, they would like their own emotional terrain to be respected and kept private, not spoken of. Kind of like when you see a cat absently stretching and then falling off the table, and then you look at them and they're like, ha, we will not mention this ever again, you know.
Except the difference it's funny because humans are so picky and finicky. We have to have things just so, and our feelings and our inputs and our outputs. You know, the cat just falls and just whatever, gets up, nothing of it, you know.
We will not mention this again. And it's like, yeah, it's true. And it's a good thing, because of the language barrier, you can't mention it again. And also, they're so rationally in the present moment that they don't speak, as far as I can tell, they don't really like spend much time in the past or future.
No.
They're very in the present moment, and that would be the way to live a nice, healthy life, which you can see evident in most, pretty much any mammal that you can identify. They're very much in the present moment. And you can see that evident in every single child, you know, under 3, of course. They're very in the present moment. And this is an aspect of, I might speak of someone's emotions, but not if it's going to sound like I'm psychologizing them.
Yeah.
Are you feeling this? It's like, that could be very intrusive. So I'd be very cautious about jumping to that. Standard nonviolent communication tactics, they often teach people to go right to speaking of what someone else is feeling. I would very much highly caution both that And I would also caution the use of the word need, because there's a definition wobble. Need could be confused for people to mean physiological need. I prefer motivating factors, and I would be more specific. I prefer desires and values. Do you desire this? Do you have a value for that? It's common. I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't have a value or desire for anything. You know, someone, you always have it for something. So this was the intangible side, both the feelings and the motivating factors or needs, as methodology of creating a bridge of empathy. On the other side, the tangible side, I could use that, observations. I could speak directly to how it is that the other person is observing the situation, how the other person heard the words or saw the action, and try to reiterate to them with a question if I'm not sure, and then speaking it back to them if they gave it to me, how they essentially would see what went down, the whether words or actions, etc. I could also choose to speak to how I observed it, unless, of course, that seemed to be very much opposed to how they observed it, and that could be contradictory. There's always this conflict happens when people consider that you're contradicting them, because they're thinking in usually through the lens of either or. Either it's my observations or it's your observations. But it's not like more like points of perspective and vantage point. I could also choose to look through the lens of actions or requests. I could see essentially the, you know, I could speak directly to the actions that the other person chose to make, unless it sounds like I'm giving them a diagnosis for how they chose their actions. You know, I have to be careful on how I choose to word things. I could also speak to my own actions, unless, of course, that sounds like I am in some way making a demand of them. So you can hear like the way I'm using OFNR, observations, feelings, needs, requests, to build a bridge, eight different methods. Those were ways of connecting to say, hey, you are alive over there, and I am paying attention to various aspects of what that means in a practical way. So I don't have to fully put the attention span on them if that would be uncomfortable. Likewise, I won't fully put the attention span on me and how I'm feeling if that would also be off-putting for them.
Now, let's talk about politicians, because they know words that work and they use tactical phrases and words to influence results. So anyone could use this, but use it for sinister results, correct?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Let's, so how do you pick out the bullshitter?
Yeah, so I think maybe what you were asking is how do I identify probably, let's see, like lying with malicious intent or that type of thing where someone is essentially selling something. That, you know,
sure.
Politicians are just one way of selling something. There are many people who are selling something. I think it comes down to identifying what is the product being sold. And that's just the trivium method of identification, of removing euphemisms if possible. So one word equals one thing. And also where you're finding flags of abstractions. So, you know, I did mention the static trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric. That's static. I mentioned an active aspect of rhetoric called the rhetorical triangle. That's the intimate knowledge, or I would say explicit, explainable knowledge of the author and all of the motivating factors and the emotions going on with the author, that's me right now, and also the audience, that's you, and potentially I'm extrapolating everyone potentially listening. I know some of them. And all of the emotions that they could be potentially feeling, I can hear. See, we don't have like a video Skype going on. So if I saw, I could read your body language and your facial expressions, I'd get a bead on your emotions. Mm-hmm. And likewise, from there, I'd be able to extrapolate some of your motivating factors or what it is that would generate those emotions, the values and desires that's alive in Lana. So there's that aspect of information. There's essentially just it's a need for understanding what's going on, particularly. The other active aspects of the trivium that I want to emphasize are grammar scan. It's what I would call when you have specific words that are flagged silently in your mind. I have certain words flagged, such as first person plural pronouns, we, us, our, they, them, theirs, etc., etc., especially when referred to in a collectivist manner. And you don't have to spend too much Google time looking up collectivism to understand what I'm referring to. I also have grammar scans set to flag any abstraction, such as culture, society, the greater good, the common good. these are abstractions.
All red flags for me.
Right, right. So I silently have them flagged like that, you know, and that means like I will very much, my ears perk up. I take note. I'm not necessarily going to reference this to the other person because I need to understand where they're coming from. If they are knowing what they're doing and they are intentionally trying to sell me something that, you know, they fully know that they're trying to convince me instead of demonstrate something to me and offer me something, then there is an aspect of potential manipulation going on. So it's best for me to keep my cards to myself for the moment until I figure out what's going on. The second step of logic scan is, well, very simply, the informal logical fallacy lists. It's good to know the 42. There's a good 20 of them that aren't that hard to learn. You know, essentially fallacies of ambiguity, or there's, you know, something could be essentially not very much defined. The fallacies of equivocation, where words are flipping meaning backwards and forwards, you know, now it's this, now it's that. And then, of course, there's the fallacies of the neglected aspect, the very important information being left out, and fallacies of relevance, where, in other words, completely irrelevant, such as a red herring item is brought up. I've found that many of the fallacies can be split into these four groups. So I do have that. Jumping back to grammar scan, I also have an etymology scan in my mind. Certain words I do know the etymology for. So the ancient and then recent past and then present past use of the word comes up, such as religion, for example. Fascinating etymology on that word. And likewise for the etymology of government, likewise the etymology on, a lot of words. Empathy, for example, that's a word that's not been in actual English use for even much more than 100 years, actually. So these are all important aspects. A functional grammar scan, a functional logic scan, and your functional rhetorical triangle scan, in addition to the constant OFNR internal and external scan going on, a constant 4Ds of disconnected communication scan internally, checking that I'm not making some demands of Lana externally. Did she just make a demand of me to answer this question? Or is that a request? You know, and by the way, it was a request.
Yes, it was.
So, so I'm giving you an example. These are things that, like, when it comes down to what you call politicians, people who are essentially selling a political solution to some specific situation.
Now, how would you apply these things? I don't know where you stand politically, but let's say you were in a court of law dealing with authority or government agents or the IRS.
Oh boy.
How do you communicate to that?
I didn't want to be in a court of law, but now that I'm speculating, I am. Well, that's a coercive scenario, first of all. It's a monopoly court of law. And it's not voluntary. If usually you get a subpoena, you show up there because you're under threat. The purpose of any situation where there's real cause and effect, three-dimensional, serious implications going on, that requires me to take the path of most safety. So I'm going to flow along that according to whatever would be, you know, yielding me the best results, basically. This means that I'm going to still be using all of these tools to keep myself in some states of intellectual and emotional equilibrium. And also at the same time, while I'm standing strong that way, I can see where other people are at, what motivates them. People, you know, when you can see their faces and body language, they give themselves away, emotionally speaking. And that, in turn, gives their motivating factors away, what they value and desire in any particular moment. Someone who's working in those systems values their paycheck, they value their procedure, they probably pretty much value just getting through that day and being done, you know. ease and efficiency is called that, basically. They need that simplicity of having it all flow according to the pattern that they're used to. So this makes those types of people very predictable. Unless they're a genius, unless they know everything I've just been saying, unless there's some ulterior motive going on to actually get me in some way, they are someone who, you know, can be spoken to using these ways. Meaning those bridges that I mentioned, you can utilize them to make a bridge within such a coercive scenario when someone has power over you to speak to what motivates them is a potential methodology for finding a bridge to see that, hey, I understand you're an individual and this is what you're after.
It's maybe usually, there's another way for you to get that. Money or jail, one of those.
Money or jail, sure. And so, yeah, in this instance, I probably would choose the money. So when it comes down to politically, as I tried to mention off air and I'll probably mention right now, it's definitely seeable on my blog site, essentially. I do see serious value in the non-aggression principle, meaning I'm not going to initiate aggression against someone. I will, if absolutely necessary, make attempts to defend myself. But in general, I'm going to look to do the diffusing method because I found that these methodologies I've just been explaining are pretty effective in diffusing potential conflict and aspects such as that. When it comes down to it, that does mean I'm not going to see relevance in outsourcing violence of other people on other people, which is essentially the actions of a legislature coming from a coercive monopoly government. That's one group of people forcing edicts upon another group of people for often a very provable profit for a very small minority of people. And, you know, I think I could just murder you, the YouTube that you could go to from Brett Vinat of the School Sucks podcast. It shows a pretty wonderful way of looking at all of what I just described in terms of coercive monopolies over the past 10,000 years. You know, starting with the God King and ending up with we're all the government type of, I would say, group hallucination. Mm-hmm. When in reality, it comes down to we're all individuals. That is provable. I have not seen the Borg existent. There is no, you know, everyone speaking the same words, thinking the same thoughts. There are people parroting similar thoughts, similar words, and thinking similar thoughts, but everyone is an individual, a separate island.
That's right.
So I'm looking through that lens first to see, okay, I'm removing the abstractions. I'm seeing what's going on around me. And this is the other aspect that is often not very much emphasized in traditional nonviolent communication studies and teaching is boundaries. Explicit boundaries between individuals. Having this understood so that what is mutually comfortable can be created. This is an aspect of cause and effect, saying, okay, it's nothing personal. In certain circumstances, if this happens, then likely this will happen. Some people are very highly armed. They are not going to necessarily hurt anyone. But in the middle of the night, in the midst of their home, if something breached the levels of security to go all the way through a locked door, any person who would choose to go through that, they might seriously be in danger, and it's nothing personal. They might get shot, you see. I'm presently not living amongst those people. I'm not actually highly armed. I just know people who are, and they will do that. And that's an aspect of extreme boundaries, essentially. There are minor ones, such as very simply saying, hey, you know, in this relationship, this is monogamous. If these things occur, and I'm finding out that integrity is broken, you're saying it's monogamous, and then I'm finding out it's not, then these are the actual cause and effect. This is how I'm laying it out. The relationship's over. I'm not interested in trying to rebuild trust with you. And I'm going to start over with someone else. And that's the cause and effect. So you're kind of laying out a boundary, essentially. So does that sort of explain something there?
Oh, yes, it does. Absolutely. Now, I also wanted to ask you, you talked about body language, they're speaking communication. Now, what about energetic communication? For instance, I could be sitting in a room and not say anything, or I could be sitting, you know, with a happy body language, but I could be venting hate and anger. What about that? Isn't that also a form of violence? A different kind of communication?
Well, I think if you're venting anger, I think that the major violence would be towards oneself, because from what I generally get to see, that anger, like, unless you're, you know, having, like, you have some serious psychokinetic effects with that anger upon other individuals.
Yeah, some kind of voodoo or witchcraft.
Yeah.
Unless it's actually hurting people.
Unless it's actually palpably, you know, is like there's evidence showing it is actually hurting someone physiologically or even bioenergetically, as that's another realm of my studies. I'm generally seeing it's mostly just hurting the individual because, as I did mention, it is a surface level emotion usually. I've not yet found that behind the frustration or anger is nothing. Usually I'm finding that behind it is something. It's usually whether it's grief, the missed opportunity, etc., or something like that, sadness, or anxiety, some type of consistent held fear or overwhelmed feeling or something of that sort that generates that, or actual fear, the actual palpable in danger moment, fight, flight, or freeze, the three F's essentially. One of those is usually going on behind the anger. The person just might or might not be aware of this. The hiding it behind body language is their own prerogative. It's their own aspect of privacy. I think that it's very good to respect people's privacy. It's why I mentioned not bringing up someone else's feelings unless you really are very sure that they're interested in hearing it, they're open to hearing it, and, you know, that it's not an embarrassment for them to hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, like these are very important questions to answer.
Minding your own business. That's a good one too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, looking through a healthy lens, how do you personally view problems or obstacles in life?
Ah, see, you've been reading my essay.
Yes, I have.
So, yeah, essentially, when I am standing strong, when all of these aspects are functioning as I've been describing them, I can usually take a moment to see each obstacle or problem as a potential opportunity. Now, I might not have the answers to how to change that obstacle into an opportunity, but that is the end point goal. There are many examples where people apparently, seemingly, have found obstacles and turned them into opportunities. As the Robin Hood folks over in New Hampshire, these people who essentially put coins into parking meters of expired meters, so that people do not get tickets. And then they leave a little flyer saying, hey, you just got a visit from the Robin Hood people. And, you know, these are people who are essentially trying to prevent you from getting an expensive ticket. So there was the problem, people getting tickets. It was an obstacle. And people saw it as an opportunity to spread information and messages concerning the philosophies of voluntarism and a peaceful society in general, I believe. I could be a little wrong on that, but in general, I see that this is people helping people and utilizing that as a platform to promote greater awareness on a variety of ideas and principles. And that is essentially taking a problem or an obstacle and turning it into an opportunity. So, you know, when other people would try to make a new problem out of this, essentially making it illegal to do that and trying to arrest people who do that.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, insane. Well, that's an obstacle. So I see that as an opportunity to say, ah, okay. So now full-fledged turn that into a business, meaning make an actual contract. You are working for the people whose cars are there. You could actually potentially do that and say, hey, would you like to be saved this ticket in the future? Because here you go. We can do that. We can set it up. And then, you know, essentially no official can say boo to you because you're working on behalf of the person owning the car.
Mm-hmm.
That's their property. And essentially you're working for them to feed the meter. And, you know, essentially, you know, they could pass a law making that business is not allowable. It just is one obstacle can keep becoming an opportunity. every time that there's a system of coercion, wherein there's essentially one group or an individual forcing some series of demands or actions upon another group, that's the general gist of it that I see. It's an opportunity to create a business or some type of artistic expression, or, you know, to essentially invent a product. It's innovation and creativity that happen.
Well said. I think that's a really important aspect to remember. Couple more questions for you. I want to know how you handle it when somebody personally attacks you or behaves like an asshole.
Delivering the diagnosis of like an asshole.
Yep.
So I understand what you meant by that. Again, it's that aspect of disagreeable words or actions, meaning I would prefer it have been to other words. I would prefer they chose other actions. Why? Because of my own itinerary, my own motivations, basically. So when this happens, I'm basically taking the moment to see what's going on. Here's the very important part. What's going on internally? So when I mentioned internal, emotional, and intellectual equilibrium, I was mentioning that this is the goal. If you could just start and end there, that would be fine. But to extend it to offer a helping hand up would be even better. So what I'm looking for first is, you know, to see what's behind the words. And usually, even with text that's coming at me, I can figure it out. I can usually find what is being desired a little bit. The emotions that are usually given away within text or within speech, which has voice inflection that kind of gives some of it away, or certainly when it's video or in person, and then you've got body language added to that, that just starts adding to everything. So this is just, if I have my own equilibrium, then I'm good to go and I can just see, okay, where is this person coming from? And in what way can I rebuild the bridge? Because when you, what you called acting like an asshole, or, you know, speaking as an asshole, that was them essentially making their own, what is called in nonviolent communication groups, tragic expressions of please and thank you. There's so many.
They have such a PC
terms.
Way of putting it, don't they?
Oh, yeah. It's filled with jargon terms such as that. I mean,
I'm like, not PC, as you can tell. I'm not either.
I'm definitely interested more in being somewhat more effective and authentic. So I'm looking to, first, I have to make sure that I have equilibrium. If they said something to me and it actually touches upon something, I notice real feelings coming up. They actually hit upon an aspect wherein I'm self-critical about myself. In other words, in that instance, the insult landed, okay? Mm. And I took it in because it was an area that was already sore from me applying it to myself previously. I need to acquire equilibrium again after that. That's the requirement first. And I can usually do that quickly. I pretty much, I see that in most interactions that I have professionally or privately, there's a general understanding of how long the interaction is going to go. And that means how long am I going to have to hold whatever mask on, or to hold whatever essential equilibrium that is absolutely necessary. I can essentially be saying these words to myself, quietly to myself. Wow. When they said that, instantly I noticed I was, when you described how inarticulate I was in my interview style, you know, before this interview, I really
never said that about you. I'm playing.
I know. That hit upon these feelings in me, like, yeah, I've been struggling with this for years. You know, and like I gave that own, like when I watched my own presentation on tragedy and hope, merging the trivium with nonviolent communication, my stumbling with words, all of those aspects, the way I didn't look at the camera, you know, that really connected right there, because I have a desire to communicate effectively and clearly. I have a desire for ease and efficiency. All right, so I identified all of that. What am I going to do about it? This is all done silently. And that next plan, what am I going to do about it? The actions or requests, as in the OFNR part. And the request I make of myself is, Daryl, can you just hold off until after the interview? We're going to go, take a little walk and by the ocean side. We're going to reflect on this. We're going to write some things down. And we're going to practice some statements out loud so we have articulation better for the next time around. How do you feel? And then internally, I feel so much better. I feel so much better. I can totally handle it now. And all that's done silently. And then from there, it's the aspect of, okay, what's going on? What's alive in them? What's alive in them is the catchphrase in NVC for what are they feeling and what is motivating those feelings, essentially.
So again, you took an obstacle and you spun it around to a positive light. And then you said, okay, I'm going to do better the next time.
Well, essentially, I mean, that's one way. There are other ways, like I could indulge in self-punishment protocol number 37. You know, I could do that, you know, and call myself the certain names that I have for myself. You know, I could do that. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not very effective in acquiring desired results. So I think you understand what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Words do have an energetic punch behind them, or they can be extremely uplifting and pleasant.
Right. And there, the punch requires that you actually receive it.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. So what I said before about you laughed at because you didn't receive it because you could see the ridiculous nature of it. If I gave you a label that has nothing to do with you, it would be like that too. But if I gave a label to you that you had already previously given to yourself, the punch could potentially land, basically. And it becomes like that. And so like interpreting it as a punch and no longer as just words that are someone tipping their hand as to what motivates them. That's the difference right there. So I basically am trying to promote a methodology wherein people are no longer insulted because it's an option to take the insult in. It's completely optional. I've just been revising my essay and added that aspect to it, basically. And I was giving an and also, or an alternative perspective to look through instead, wherein you take it as words. And if the words happen to land emotionally, well, equilibrium is your number one goal. But second to that is keeping in mind the three-dimensional reality that's going on. What is going on, basically, is very important. So if someone is intentionally trying to upset your equilibrium, that's important information, meaning it's important to know why they want to do that. What is the motivation behind that? Once you have that, you seriously have some, you know, you have some things that can seriously create effectiveness in terms of your designing and applying plans.
Last question for you. Taking all these principles and putting them into practice, how has your life changed? Are you just scanning all the time?
It becomes automatic and internal at this point. It's no longer scanning. It's more like an internal interpretation of words when necessary. I speak casually when I'm normally talking. This is an interview. I'm kind of partially in lecture mode right now. When I'm teaching, I'm pretty much in lecture mode. Although I am paying attention to my audience, of course. But you know, when I'm actually just, you know, shooting the shit, as they say, when I'm just speaking casually, then this is, you know, this is just stuff that's running in the background. I don't have to think about it anymore. This has been helpful in terms of I'm able to talk with people and see that there's a whole lot of people getting angry with some of the conclusions that I in the past have brought up. There's a lot more of connection. There's more of those aspects that I put into my essay of creating essentially the connection. The bridge is made. Creativity happens more often. Innovation, seeing basically the opportunity within each obstacle. That's what I'm noticing more of, Lana.
Daryl, I really appreciate you taking the time for us today. It's been great.
Thank you so much.
Can you please provide us with the details to your website?
Well, very much. Until I have a real actual website, I've been using voluntaryvisions.blogspot.com as a place where I can just throw up interviews like this, essays that I write, and other applications. I am working in collaboration with other podcasters, and I'll be aiming to start Voluntary Mind Productions in sometime in the near future and starting to have those come up.
And to everyone else, have a pleasant morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you may be.
To be broken.